What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hi guys, welcome to the Katie Halper Show. We're very excited to bring you this interview with George Shikharamaur, who caused quite the controversy when he tweeted, "All I want for Christmas is white genocide." Now, as usual, we want to remind you and encourage you to join our Patreon campaign. Go to patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow, and there you will find all sorts of bonus content and goodies, and it's definitely worth it. And you can, depending on your contribution level, you can get a calendar, a Katie Halper Show mug. Those are looking really good, really popular. Our next live show will be Wednesday, January 11th at the Brooklyn Commons. That's 388 Atlantic Avenue at 7 p.m. The theme will be the media under Trump. And our special guest will be Abby Martin of Telesur and the Empire Files and Nando Villa of Fusion. Things that you can access as a Patreon supporter are things like an extended interview with Susie Weissman and Bob Brenner, an extended interview with Ben Jealous, the audio from a never-before-released live show on Bernie Made Me White, and many more things coming down the pike, including video from our last live show and video of my interview with George Shikharamaur. See you guys next week. But first, a word from our not-so-corporate sponsor. In a world where major telecommunication companies have outsourced jobs and helped the government spy on U.S. citizens, wouldn't it be nice to use your phone as a force for good and not evil? Well, you can, thanks to Credo Mobile, a progressive phone company. Every month they take a share of their revenue, more than $150,000, and donate it to incredible progressive organizations, and that adds up. They've already contributed over $81 million to organizations like the Brennan Center for Justice, Amnesty International, and Planned Parenthood. And Credo customers vote to determine which organizations get how much money. So it's literally democracy in action. Not only does Credo fund progressive causes, but you get to use the phone of your choice with great service. Right now, Credo has a special deal for Katie Halper listeners. You guys, this is so exciting. Our own deal, guys. Go to credo.com/Katie and get 50% off unlimited talk and text for 2 years. Plus, select smartphones are free. Okay, you guys, you're getting 50% off unlimited talk and text for 2 years. And depending on which phone, you could get the phone for free. It'll be a smartphone. We're not talking flip phones. Just go to credo.com/KATIE. That's credo.com/KATIE. credo.com/Katie, or call 1-800-260-1254. That's 1-800-260-1254. And tell them Katie Halper sent ya. Don't forget that part. It's time your phone company represented your values. So go to credo.com/Katie today.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Katie Halper Show. Thanks so much for listening to the Katie Halper Show. You can hear us every Wednesday at 7 p.m. WBAI, that's WBAI.org, or 99.5 FM. Hi, Reggie. How are you?
Hey, Katie.
How's it going?
Well, you know, it's winter in New York. It's sort of got, it was warm at one point and then it's gotten cold, and it was warm at one point and then it gotten cold again. You know, fluctuation. But of course, there's no such thing as climate change.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, it's true. It's winter. It reminds me of springtime for Hitler in Germany, is the song from The Producers, that great Mel Brooks poem.
Right.
And now it's springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is happy and gay. We're marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes the master race.
And now, of course, it's winter for Donald Trump in America. How do you like that?
Winter in, wait.
It's winter for Donald Trump in America.
Winter in Donald Trump in America. Okay.
So we're really excited to bring you a very special show today. You may have heard of someone who's been in the news lately, George Ciccarello Maher. George Ciccarello Maher.
I sort of heard of him.
You sort of heard of him?
I sort of heard of him.
He gained fame for a very controversial, allegedly controversial tweet. He is an associate professor of international politics at the Philadelphia-based Drexel University. And Sarah Lazar has a really great article about this in Alternate. And just to set it up a little bit, what happened was on December 24th, Ciccarello Maher posted a tweet stating, "All I want for Christmas is white genocide," end quote. He explained the tweet in a later statement, quote, "For those who haven't bothered to do their research, white genocide is an idea invented by white supremacists and used to denounce everything from interracial relationships to multicultural policies, and most recently, against a tweet by State Farm Insurance. It is a figment of the racist imagination. It should be mocked, and I'm glad to have mocked it." Okay, and by the way, the State Farm Insurance ad that was attacked for leading to white genocide is literally of a black man and a white woman, and he's holding an engagement ring. So these are the types of things, of threats, that people, white supremacists, call white genocide. Get it?
Yeah, that's the true threat of the country, indeed.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I can't sleep at night knowing about all the black men proposing to white women, all the white women proposing to black women. I mean, don't even get me started on that.
Oh, no, no. Now you're opening up a whole new can of worms on that one.
Exactly. That's just awful. I should have given a trigger warning. I hope my white supremacist listeners are sitting down, because I got a lot of them. I'm sure I do.
Well, you know, as long as the white supremacist listeners donate to WBAI so they can continue to be more offended here,
true.
You know, so as long as they give money, they could be offended as long as they want to be.
Yeah, they're allowed to be from anyone.
Yeah,
really,
they're allowed to be offended. And we thank you, white listeners who are supremacists, who are who are WBAI supporters. We appreciate it.
I love the idea that we're reaching a single person right now. I mean,
I don't
maybe.
Know. It could be.
You never know.
You never know.
Could be a very smart person who realizes that to have his finger on the pulse of the left, of the transformational left, the left that will really change things up, they know, how do I know what's happening? How do I try to stay one step ahead? Got to listen to what Katie Halper's saying on the Katie Halper Show on WBAI. Now, how do I make sure that show sticks around, which is my little portal into the left? I got to make sure it's funded. So thank you, Franz.
Right. And so they're woke and also offended at the same time.
Exactly.
That's a good thing.
They're not. I mean, oh, I see. They're woke in. Right.
Yeah, they're
you know,
woke in.
The Katie Halper Show. Remember
they're
what we are?
Yeah, they're woke in.
Right.
And they're
we're
offended.
Not. Right. We're woke at the wheel. We're
woke,
at the wheel,
at the wheel.
That is the slogan of the
well,
show.
Well, it more like being shaken up, and whether they're woke or not is up
right.
to them.
But we're woke at the wheel.
Yes.
We are woke at the wheel. Yeah,
right.
That's our slogan, our motto.
Right.
So what happened was after he tweeted this, Breitbart, the white nationalist publication, wrote about it. And in the comments sections, of course, there was a death threat and lots of heinous, awful things. messages that were against LGBTQ, African Americans, and the story spread to Reddit and 4chan, and before long, Sarah Lazar writes in Alternate, before long, George Ciccarella Marr had become target of a coordinated campaign to contact his employer, Drexel University. Ciccarella Marr said he awoke Christmas morning to death threats targeting him and his family.
Wow.
But Drexel, instead of defending Ciccarella Marr, appeared to be swayed by the pressure it received and publicly condemned his social media remarks as, quote, utterly reprehensible and deeply disturbing. Just to explain a little bit more about this, what happens is that Lowndes says, quote, fears of the decline of so-called white race have been around for a long time with different iterations. In the American context, it goes back to fears of slave revolt. You can see it in Thomas Jefferson's notes. When he described slavery as holding a, quote, wolf by the ears, end quote, he claimed that once you let the wolf go, it will turn on you and devour you. Okay. Anyway, so that's some of the background. And again, anyone who studies this and looks at this stuff knows very well that white genocide is a term that's used by people who are white supremacists to describe anything that they see as threatening to white supremacy. That's actually, in that context, it is you could call it white supremacy genocide. It's the attempt to genocide, kill, to get rid of white
supremacy.
So the
genocide is the supremacy. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, I'm saying if you think of genocide as elimination, right?
Right, right.
You could say that it would be white supremacy genocide that we want.
I get what you're
saying.
Which
isn't genocide. We're not killing anyone. We're not calling for anyone to be killed.
It's the death of an ideology.
Exactly. Yes. Right. You nailed it, as usual, Reggie. Yeah, yes, yeah. Thank you. Reggie reins me in. And so, again, just want to give you that background. Drexel offered a very lukewarm response, which was like, of course he has the freedom of speech. You can say whatever he wants. But that's utterly reprehensible because they have no idea what he was talking about. Which is fine. Like, it's not their fault that they don't know this. But what you do before issuing a public statement is probably ask the person what he meant. Or, like, do a Google. Go to the Google. And type it in. And so he tweeted again. He tweeted, just to reiterate, all I want for Christmas is white genocide. And then he tweeted later on, to clarify, when the whites were massacred during the Haitian Revolution, that was a good thing indeed. And then he deleted the first tweet and made his Twitter private. Now, again, the reason that he, just to clarify, we talk about this in the interview that we're about to play, but the reason he talks about the Haitian Revolution is because while he's saying that, no, he's not calling for any violence right now in this context, he's saying that he doesn't condemn all violence in all circumstances, and especially in this historical circumstance, right? And, of course, violence against slave owners is very different from violence perpetuated by people who are free, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the context. And just so you know, for when we talk about his Haiti quote, the tweet was to clarify, when the whites were massacred during the Haitian Revolution, that was a good thing indeed. The good news is that Drexel University, Ciccarello says that they are now standing by him and supporting him fully, which is good because they got a lot of bad press because their response was so laughable. And the other thing that you should know is that it did get a lot of press. He's getting death threats, and he talks about this. But also there was a change.org petition in support of him and kind of telling Drexel to stand by him 100%. And that got over 7,000 signatures. So, yeah, that's all that you need to know. And thanks again. And have a great new year, guys. And we'll see you next Wednesday.
All right.
All righty. Bye.
All right. Here we go.
We are so excited to be speaking to George Ciccarello Marr, an associate professor of politics and global studies at Drexel University. And he's also the author of We Created Chavez, A People's History of the Venezuelan Revolution. Welcome, George.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and thanks for taking time out of the holiday cheer.
It's been really cheerful, as you can imagine.
Yeah, so can you tell us about your latest brush with right-wing infamy?
So I've been, in a sense, I've had some experience with this. Often it's, you know, some right-wing police supporting groups in the United States have taken offense at some of my tweets before. But this time it's really it's been a qualitatively different phenomenon in the sense that a tweet that I sent out on Christmas Eve was picked up by a systematic right-wing smear campaign organized between sort of Breitbart and the sewer of Reddit. To organize, a campaign of harassment against not only me and my family, but also my employer, which has seen my colleagues and myself subject to hundreds and hundreds of kind of violent, racist, and misogynistic emails over the past couple of days.
And can you tell us a little bit about how the tweet transpired, what you were doing when you tweeted it?
I mean, I was essentially relaxing with family, and what came across my Twitter feed, which was the sort of virulent response to a State Farm ad, which showed a black man proposing to a white woman, and the number of responses to it was really, really shocking. All hashtagged white genocide, saying I'm never going to support this insurance company again because they're encouraging the downfall of the white race. And for anyone who's paid any attention or spent 30 seconds on Google, you know that white genocide is a mythical construct of the far right, racist, white supremacists of the United States and elsewhere, who believe that that white America is collapsing due to low birth rates, intermarriage, and policies and cultures of diversity. In this sense, it of course makes perfect sense to be happy at what is frightening white supremacists. And so I sent out a satirical tweet mocking this made-up idea, this non-existent thing. And it was quickly picked up by right-wing news sites and put into this sort of outrage machine, which is well-connected at this point, which has direct lines to not only Fox News and other outlets, but increasingly to the White House, and will have a voice in the White House in the future. And so I think, in one sense, this has been going on for a while and for a lot of people. There are a lot of people, especially on universities, who are subject to this kind of harassment and scrutiny, in particular women and people of color. At the same time, I think we all need to reflect on the fact that we are at a kind of turning point where the far right feels empowered and is going to be more aggressive when it comes to these questions.
Right. So you were basically mocking, simultaneously, like stating solidarity with people who are in interracial relationships or just committed to diversity, and also mocking the idea that this is actually any sort of white genocide, correct?
Absolutely. So, yeah. And some of the follow-up tweets have said, well, you know, if white, what about, how does this not exist? And I say, well, of course, whiteness is not a race. And I say, well, then blackness is not a race. I said, well, right. You know, these things are not biological things. No one really should believe that they are anymore. They're constructed. They have very real political consequences in the world, but those consequences are diametrically opposed to one another. You know, you've got racial identity that implies power and authority, and one that implies the opposite, guilt and scrutiny. And so I think people are struggling on the one hand to keep up with what it is that the right wing, the far right, means by this paranoid white genocide meme, but also people are struggling with what it means to understand race in a political way that doesn't mean essentializing it as biological.
Right, there's always that, right? Like, or it's kind of similar to the argument like, well, whatever, like if we want to get over racism, then we have to stop talking about race or stop seeing race. So like, how can we have affirmative action if we want to get over racism?
Absolutely. The colorblind myth, right? And this is the essential myth of the Obama years. It's this idea that we've gotten over it, that we're in a post-racial era, and lo and behold, police keep killing people. Lo and behold, black people keep resisting. And suddenly the country is very different in many good ways, right? Because people are standing up, people are fighting back, and people are no longer kind of subject to this myth that racism has gone into the past.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I had a show last week. I did a live show. It was on identity politics. And one of the guests, this guy, Kazembe Balagan, who was used to be at the Bresch Center, Bresch Forum, he made this point about how in some ways identity politics is the response to the post-racial myth. And all of us on stage had a very, like, identity politics is is a good thing, but it's not enough. Basically, like the thing that Sanders said that got him into so much trouble when he said that we have to move beyond it, which clearly meant go further than keep it, but go further than, like, it's necessary but insufficient. Anyway, but he was talking about how that the people who really challenged the post-racial idea was actually Black Lives Matter. But
and I think it's true. I mean, I think the degree to which these movements have changed the country is dramatic. And part of what we're seeing in Trump is a backlash against that. I mean, it's a backlash against other things as well. But it's a backlash against the fact that people are standing up. And I think we need to understand that these, you know, in a sense, you know, there are very valid criticisms of identity politics. I think they're also, you know, both sides are going go overboard and push the stick too far in the other direction, because identity and the way we understand ourselves is crucial, but also that, you know, white supremacy is a founding, you know, element of what of class oppression in the United States and always has been. And unless we get over it, we're really just kind of telling people to get over themselves and kind of join the big working class, which is, has not always been, you know, been a winning equation for a lot of people of color in this country.
Sure. I guess, right, and then the other side of that is the don't ever talk about class because then you're being racist, as if there aren't intersections. I mean, that's the most frustrating, that's been the most frustrating thing. By the way, you can laugh because it's a radio show and we try to be funny, so people, this all, I always say this and people think I'm faking it and like urging people to laugh, but it's really when I see them laughing and I know that they're trying to be polite and not make noise, but yeah.
This no, it's because we've got this video and you know, I can see your sort of animated hand motions.
Yeah.
And
where, you know. Are you, that's very anti-Semitic of you.
Yeah. Oh, I thought it was anti-Italian. So that's why I was punching at.
No, we should do. I'm just kidding. Saying Italians are Bush Jews at the end of the day. There's a lot that we share. I'm a Bernie Jew, by the way. He just defines all of me now. Secular, not religious. So you had people responding who got the joke. Like you had the real white supremacists who got that you were mocking them. But then I think you had a lot of liberals and people in general who were confused, right?
Right. I mean, in a sense, I think the white supremacists got it on the one hand, but their response was totally in bad faith because they were saying two things. They were saying, this person gets what we mean by white genocide. In other words, falling birth rates, diversity politics, et cetera. But at the same time, now we're going to act him as though what he's saying is actual literal killing of millions of people.
Right.
And, you know, of
Wait,
course,
you're
that's
saying
not...
white supremacists acted in bad faith? Get
yeah,
out
no, it's
here.
Shocking. Right? So, it's shocking. Yeah. And so and this is how they then fed it into the mainstream. This is how they then sanitized it, the way that they're sanitizing Trump, the way that they're sanitizing themselves with this label of alt-right. And, you know, and they put it into this narrative, which then got a lot of momentum. And they got a lot of momentum because people say, well, of course it's, you know, of course genocide is a terrible thing. I mean, except for the fact that there's never been a white genocide. And yet these are the same people that don't want to talk about black and brown genocide, that don't want to talk even about the Holocaust. And that, you know, I've gotten, as I said, hundreds of emails and threats, you know, speculating that I'm Jewish, speculating that I'm something else, calling me mystery meat. And, you know, and at the end of the day, using a whole range of racist and, you know, and of course, deeply sort of the deep paranoid sexuality of the far right that comes out of the with the labels of the cuck and the beta and the calling me low T and all of these, of course, you know, really interesting slurs that I've never been subjected to before. And, you know, and it's an amazing mechanism that they've got moving these days because the mainstream media ate it right up and knew what they were doing. You know, when Hannity and Tucker Carlson, you know, are, you know, pushing these lines, they know what it is that they're doing. They know that they're enabling a narrative that is white supremacist. Many of them, like Ann Coulter, are not even ashamed about this. You know, she, of course, calls for the final solution for indigenous peoples. So this is not something that it's not as though they don't know that this is happening. It's not as though they don't know that this encourages violence against people of color, queer and trans people, women in this country.
And how would you explain how that happens for skeptics who say, oh, this is just words, whatever?
I mean, people are attacking people in the streets. And then, of course, people are threatening me and my family and I think with good reason, there's concern about what goes on college campuses and the level of violence that's been brought to college campuses and the fact that people, whether they understand something or not, and here, you know, willing to receive criticism on this point as well, which is that, you know, someone that doesn't know or know the context of a tweet may be willing to, you know, to pick up a gun and do something extreme. And you know, I mean, that doesn't pardon that person because, of course, you know, very few people would bother to, you know, to engage in that kind of activity without understanding what it is that they're doing it for. But you know, we live in a world in which people's most irrational, paranoid fears at the deepest core of their white being are being encouraged and being stoked. And we've seen what that can do in the streets. I think we're going to see a lot more of it because when we in movements take to the streets to resist deportations, if we take to the streets to resist police brutality, suddenly we're actually going to also be confronted with Trump soldiers in the streets. Whether Trump wants them there or, you know, or says that he doesn't want them there, they're going to be there. And I think we need to understand what it means to defend ourselves, understand what it means to keep ourselves safe. And of course, I'm getting an abject lesson in that this week. And glad to, you know, to know that there are movements and, you know, and comrades out there, who are putting in work to make that happen. And so, you know, these are things that we're going to have to deal with going forward. We've got, you know, when something like this happens, you know, and your life is sort of suddenly thrown into a chaos, you wonder, well, what, you know, did this have to happen? And the reality is that it's going to happen. It's going to happen to many of us. If it doesn't happen, it's probably because we're self-censoring. It's because we're trying not to be too provocative, and these people are not going to go away. This far right, resurgent far right, is not going anywhere if we ignore it.
So, what in terms of the responses that you got? I mean, I'm wondering what were surprising, what were expected. If you got support from people who you never thought would have come out of the woodwork to support you, who have very different ideas from yours, but were moved by the story because of freedom of speech, various issues. And if you had any surprising people who maybe you think threw you under the bus that you didn't expect to do that.
Well, I was first surprised because the statement put out by my employer, by Drexel, did not reflect what I thought I was going to see in that statement. I didn't expect to see a glowing endorsement of provocative tweeting, but Drexel has always encouraged me to, you know, to be a participant in, you know, in public debates. And it's a great thing about universities like Drexel that they encourage that kind of thing. I did not expect that it would be deemed reprehensible, especially I did not expect that they would not even realize in some senses that it was satirical or not do any research and see, you know, what had happened. So in terms of being thrown under the bus, that was a bit what that felt like. Other than that, you know, the response, of course, from the hateful trolls has been not surprising. But what has been surprising is that it's coordinated through kind of website forms, obviously. So emails, masses of emails coming in with misleading subjects that are used to make you click on them. It would say things like course spring 2017 or something like that. And they're made to, you know, to attract your attention and get you to open them. But I mean, other than that, there's been a really, really amazing outpouring of support. And this, you know, for I think analytical purposes, comes from two directions. You know, my own understanding of it is not strictly a free speech question or an academic freedom question, although I think academic freedom is a very important shield that we need to use these days. And there are organizations, even what I consider to be, you know, non-friendly organizations like FIRE, releasing statements in support of it over this question of free expression. And I appreciate that. At the same time, I think that has to be supplemented with an understanding of what it is that is going on, what it is that we're talking about, and the fact that we're dealing with the question of the resurgent far right, what the content of that means, and giving a little more kind of flesh to those bones when we think about what these questions are all about. And so for me, you know, that's really the heart of the matter, namely the fact that we do not have a choice but to fight back against this resurgent in fascism. And we need to understand that we need to use free expression to do that. We need to also defend the content of that because being, you know, the old line that says, you know, I loathe and hate what you're saying, but you have a right to say it, is in some ways what Drexel said. And I'm glad that they uphold my right to academic freedom and expression. At the same time, saying that things are reprehensible when what we're actually trying to do is fight back the most reprehensible people and movements and organizations on the planet at this moment is an exercise in bad faith that opens us up to greater attacks.
And what about your statement about the Haitian Revolution?
It was tweeted out as a clarification of sorts. I think it's a little different, right? Because it's not actually a question of, first of all, you know, if there's a lot of explanation. In a sense, it's not a genocide. I understand the Haitian Revolution, and I study the Haitian Revolution through people like C.L.R. James and the great book, The Black Jacobins, who understand that the whites in Haiti were slave owners and were in support of slavery, in support of the return of slavery. And this was a political act to repress and massacre those whites. And the reality is, when you're fighting slavery, you fight it by all means. When you're fighting white supremacy, you fight it by all means. And there's no really reason to think of that as anything but. But at the same time, this was not a satirical tweet. This is a very straightforward historical tweet, and I actually think it's a pretty uncontroversial position to take. I believe some right-wing website picked up a tweet that said it's always justified for slaves to kill their masters. And again, I don't understand how that could be a controversial statement. I mean, as the great, political theorist Dave Chappelle put it once, he said, I'd kill a slave master on every episode if I could. And it's because slavery is illegitimate, right? And what is difficult about our moment is that we've been sort of driven, had this idea driven into our heads that all opinions are okay, and therefore rational discussion and debate is how we deal with opinions. And yet we are in a moment in which totally illegitimate opinions are in power. And this raises very important questions about whether or not we are obligated or whether or not we should recognize the presidency of Trump, recognize its legitimacy, or accept anything that comes down the pipe, because there are opinions, there are politics, there are ideas that are bad and that need to be destroyed.
It's interesting, right? Because this often happens. I'll often, less now, but before the joke on the left would be kind of like, oh, look at them calling us commies and we're so not commies. Now it's different because we're finally talking about like communism and socialism. So it almost obfuscates things, right? Communists, and we don't get to the point, which is that there's some really good things in communism, right? And so this is a similar thing in which it's kind of like you're clearly mocking the idea that anything that they're calling genocide is actually genocide, and you're clearly not calling for violence in this context, right? But then you're kind of saying, well, but FYI, I'm not
not a pacifist.
Yeah, you're not
certainly
a pacifist.
Not someone who, and someone who understands that fighting is what we need to do. That there are moments in which when we're fighting against things and systems that are so violent and so brutal and need to die, as John Brown put it, that it's a war. And that's what it looks like. But, of course, with more time, you understand that the Haitian Revolution was, again, not a genocide. The Haitian revolutionary government converted a whole number of what we would understand to be white soldiers who fought for the revolutionary cause to honorary blackness, and did this really amazing thing of declaring all soldiers and all citizens of Haiti black, as a way of subverting the role of whiteness in the world. And it was really this amazing symbolic gesture carried out after the Haitian Revolution. And the Haitian Revolution is this hugely important historical phenomenon that is erased from history, that is drained of all of its historical importance, when it actually was a motor and a contributing factor to the simultaneous revolution in France that we placed at the center of our historical understanding.
Right. Conveniently not including Haiti. But I mean, my thing has been for a while that I'm not an ideological pacifist or kind of a purist when it comes to pacifism. But I feel like in the United States and in Israel, those two places are two places where we are not going to get it done through violence because we're so out armed. I mean, it's and we clearly people on the left, we are appropriately enough always indicting, how militarized the U.S. government is and how militarized the Israeli government is, right? I kind of do always feel this on a gut level, at least, it's just not going to work. That we really need to, my theory is that we need to make nonviolence really butch and sexy. So people, and I think we should be making nonviolent direct action films. Not sure what they'd look like, but it would be good. And I'm generalizing and joking somewhat, but I'm also kind of serious. I think that so much of males, so much masculinity, if we just reframed it a little bit, it would be so great.
I mean, I think, yeah, no, I think that's largely true. The question is a strategic one, heavily, right?
Exactly.
Right? What is going to win? But it's also a question, and I'm very much a Fanonian. Franz Fanon is a huge inspiration of mine, and in my book that comes out next month, actually, Decolonizing Dialectics, talks about a lot of these questions, and it talks about violence, because Fanon is understood to be this apostle of sort of bloodthirsty decolonial violence, and yet what Fanon is most concerned with is, on the one hand, winning, right? And that's his starting point. And when he says that decolonization is an inherently violent phenomenon, what he means in part is that the colonizer won't leave voluntarily. Now, what kind of force is necessary to drive colonizers out is the question. And even Gandhi recognized, he said, we need force, but I call it soul force, and this is what it looks like. But for Fanon, the other piece is very important, especially for Black and colonized peoples, which is the self-transformation through struggle. And this is really the central piece, which is that people standing up for themselves and fighting against an oppressor changes who they are, makes them into what he calls as humans, right? They move from being a thing to being a human, and it radicalizes their very nature. And this is central to him. It's part of what he understands as violence. But it's also something that can happen through struggle that is nonviolent. It can happen through struggle that is combative, that is confrontational. And every time you stand up against someone, really, you feel that. And I think that's an essential part of what we need to understand. And then the final piece is that you know, Mike Brown, Trayvon Martin, Renisha McBride, for Fanon, they were violent. Why? Because they were Black in a white world. They stood for and were already violent, and there is nothing they could have done that would have made them nonviolent. If they sat down in the street and crossed their arms, you would see descriptions in the press of these sort of aggressive, Black youth. And so the final piece for him is the inescapability of that. And so when we can't escape, or when certain subjects can't escape being deemed violent, then you got this question of how is it that you can be nonviolent, and is nonviolent almost like a privileged position to occupy? And you get this a lot, right, in Israel and Palestine, in these productive debates between kind of Israeli peace activists and Palestinians. And it's not to say that Israelis support nonviolence and Palestinians support armed struggle necessarily, but the question of what possibilities exist for who is a very important one in these questions.
Right. Yeah, to me, it's always been like, I mean, I think we have to be honest about the false equivalency and violence and self-defense. Violence perpetuated by oppressed people is so not the same as the violence committed by the state or violence committed by the privileged person, right, at all. But again, it is a question of strategy. And I think we have to talk about it in a way that makes it clear that we're not condemning. It's not just a moral issue, because I think we lose a lot of people if we do it that way, going back to the strategy. But of course, I think it is very morally different. Yeah, because I mean, how do you see resistance as an academic? But do you consider yourself an organizer, or do you?
Yeah, no, of course. I organize. I live in Mexico City right now, and so I'm taking a bit of a hiatus. But historically organized first in the Bay Area, or not first, but around the murder of Oscar Grant, in a number of organizations that transformed the city through mass revolts and even rioting. And the recent years have been a kind of reminder of this. I've been in Philly during that time, organizing again around Trayvon Martin, around police brutality in the case of Brandon Tate Brown, and really pushing hard and winning some victories against the police commissioner, Charles Ramsey, who's now, Obama's kind of point person on these questions. But what we've seen nationally is that people rebelling, revolting in the streets, resisting, refusing the binders of their traditional organizations or of these sort of self-appointed Black leadership that is very much sold out to the power structure, and just taking to the streets themselves have changed the landscape of the country. That is what changed, right? Kianga Yamada Taylor's book, From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, is really an amazing account of this. And it shows very clearly not only how Black perceptions change in the 60s as in today, but also how this has impacted white sentiment, right? And the fact that people now are more likely to understand the structural realities of what Black Americans go through. And that shows up in polling data. It shows up, and it's a really important, crucial, element in understanding the role of autonomous Black struggles, right? And this gets back to the question of, it's not so much that we all get together around a basic platform of sort of $15 an hour or whatever else and claim that that's going to unify the working class. It's that Black struggles in the streets also help to propel the country as a whole, and to propel poor people and working people to get together and to struggle with these questions and to get over these questions.
Right. Can you tell us about your book that you're working on?
So I got a book that just came out on Venezuela called Building the Commune. That's about taking over space, building self-managed and radically democratic production in Venezuela in a very, very difficult time, a time of macroeconomic and political instability in which kind of the glimmer of hope comes from these grassroots communes that are spreading across the country. And my book that's about to come out, Decolonizing Dialectics, is a little more theoretical, but at the same time, it begins with and deals with a lot of these questions about what it means that our moment is one of struggle, that people are taking to the streets worldwide. That we've got movements from Tahrir Square to Occupy to the Indignados across Latin America, struggling against the sort of neoliberal capitalist offensive of recent decades, and pushing back against that, and what it means to fight it, and what kind of conceptions we need, drawing on thinkers from Latin America to the Caribbean to Fanon, this sort of transnational decolonial thinker, and thinking through what it means to struggle in this present moment, trying to bring together the best elements of Hegelian and Marxist dialectics with radical struggles for decolonization that predated and continue today.
Some of the questions I got from Twitter. Are you surprised Drexel University was seemingly unaware of the concept of white genocide and how it's used by white supremacists?
I was disappointed. I think universities are complex institutions that are trying to do damage control as quickly as possible. And there are a lot of forces at play, some good and some bad. And so I definitely wish they had put the effort into understanding that it was satire at the very least. Putting that in the statement would have clarified a lot of things right from the beginning, rather than acting as though it were actually a straightforwardly factual tweet. And this gets to the other question, which is I think Fox News is shockingly, Fox News is doing me a disservice because they're saying that I'm claiming that it was a joke, but satire is not joking, satire is dead serious. And the people that we're dealing with and we're trying to humiliate and take down are dead serious. And so I think we need to understand the difference between joking and satire.
That's such an important point.
And I made the mistake of joking about being hacked, which I thought was clearly a joke as well. And then Breitbart thought that was
really funny,
as well.
Yeah.
But no, of course I wasn't hacked, And, people are right that would mean I've been hacked every single day for the past 3 years. And calling it a joke does a discredit to what we're actually trying to do in the world.
Right. I like this one. Put this on your website. How does he carry around those enormous balls? Most people would still be under the couch with a million Nazis after them. I know that's very gendered.
My response would be that, I've been called a ballless cuck by the trolls. So, I think there's our answer.
There you go. There you go. They're doing you a favor. They're keeping you humble.
Yes.
Do you know Arun Gupta? Do you know him personally?
Yes. Arun? Okay. No, not really. Not personally.
He stands behind you, but he doesn't like the soul patch. He draws the line at anything associated with Fred Durst. Just telling what he said.
I need to clarify this, actually. This is a really important point, is that a lot of the pictures circulating of me, I have a soul patch. And yet the reality is that I've actually had a beard for well over a year now. And this is actually, it's a really important clarification. I can't let that one sit out there in the ether.
Yeah, good for you. You hear that, guys? Stop the smears.
There's no soul patch involved.
Yeah, but there has been a soul patch. Have you or were you ever a donor of a soul patch?
There are pictures that would confirm the presence of a soul patch, absolutely.
Okay. And you know what? A lesser man than you would say that they were photoshopped, but you own
photoshopped, etc. Yeah.
You'll have to come back and tell us inside the mind of a soul patch wearing man. It can be your memoirs. So I'm glad we got the soul patch one. It's super important. Does this message of racial division conflict with communist desire to promote class consciousness?
Absolutely not. I mean, the reality is that communism has been historically a go-to resource for Black liberation struggles. a whole number of, and this is the, these kind of comments are really, you know, what's most frustrating is that they in fact erase a whole history of Black revolutionary communists in the party and outside of the party, the African Blood Brotherhood, a whole, you know, radical militants in the party attempting to struggle with and force a rigid party to deal with, you know, to deal with these questions, which it did very well for a number of years and then retreated on, at which point you had Black communists leaving the party over very clear, you know, very clear points. But the important point and the point recognized by everyone from people like Richard Wright, who was definitely more of a traditional communist, to C.L.R. James, who's more of a radical Trotskyist, to people in the present who uphold and support the radical potential of Black Lives Matter and other movements is that autonomous Black struggles are crucial to pushing forward class struggles. You know, you have people like Adolf Reed coming out and attacking Black Lives Matter as inherently bourgeois, or implying that it entails unifying with the so-called Black bourgeoisie when it does not, and failing to recognize not only the class content of these struggles, which is, of course, sometimes clouded by identity-type politics, but also the fact that what has happened over the past couple of years is undeniable, and the fact that these things are inextricably tied to and bound with the question of race, and that the best lesson for if we're talking about the white working class or white workers or poor white people, the best and most transformative lesson is to not only struggle alongside Black people for their liberation, but to see that happen, to see people stand up and fight. And that is what changes minds. And that is what has shifted this country in a dramatic way over the past couple of years. And class unity can only be the product of struggle over this question of race in the United States, because it's always been so central. Du Bois and Black Reconstruction is the best account of this. The class has been divided. The white working class needs to be pulled into an understanding of class unity. And the question is, how does that come about? And it doesn't come about through ignoring it.
You just reminded me of so much when you were talking, a lot of the Bernie Sanders stuff, right? And I actually know the guy Leslie Lee. I've had him on my show a bunch of times. Leslie Lee created the Bernie Made Me White hashtag, which was in response to, I don't know if you know the story behind that. His tweet being, ever since Bernie made me white, I've been watching Friends nonstop or binging on Friends. But the whole, like, the ironic, unintentionally ironic, tragically ironic invisibilization and erasure of POC Sanders supporters. Like, every time a white person or a person of color was like, portraying Sanders supporters as all straight white young dudes, it was like, you realize you're doing exactly like what you're accusing him mm-hmm. and his campaign of doing, which is turning, you know, POC into a monolith and mm-hmm. Failing to recognize them. So we see so much of this horrible, divisive, like pseudo woke, but actually totally neoliberal, conservative, centrist, Democrat stuff that's saying, you know, any talk of class consciousness is racist, or, oh, it's easy, you know, like Hillary's thing about well, breaking up the banks and racism, no, as if Sanders was ever like, by the way, once we break up the banks, we're never gonna have to worry about racism, which he didn't say. And the other story, of course, is that, yeah, there the people most hard hurt, like the most hurt by the housing crisis, the bubble, was for POC specific, especially Black people. Anyway, so how do we speak to class in a way that doesn't kind of ignore or erase the significant differences that are the Black experience, the white experience, the Latin experience, the every experience?
Yeah, and I think that's an essential question, because there were really sharp and interesting debates after the election, right? Because the initial response of some people was to say, racist elected Trump. And the initial response of other people was to say the abandoned white working class elected Trump. And then people would say, well, the working class isn't all white. You know, who is it that we're talking about? Who has been abandoned? How does that account for what is clearly an uptick in racism? And I think but the reality is that race and class intersect. You know, people that are abandoned, that abandonment is going to be, you know, people have been abandoned by decades of Clintonism and Bushism, and that is going to harden in different ways into racism by white people in a way that it, of course, won't in people of color. And we need to understand that this sediments over time, and it becomes separated by communities, and Black communities are going to respond in very different ways as white communities. And the Clintons, of course, tapped into the Black communities for store, this expected support that never delivered any goods to those communities. And so I don't think either of these answers really accounts for what's going on if we're trying to deal with these real difficult questions. And on top of all of that, Clinton hardly lost and could have won in a number of ways just by campaigning a couple more times, or by, you know, the votes she could have won on the votes of blacks who didn't turn out to vote, or she could have won on the votes of, you know, of poor whites. Yeah.
Going to Wisconsin, maybe.
Yeah. And so, I mean, there are lots of different ways. And I think that's part of what makes the argument so complicated. But we need to understand that communities have very, very, very different experiences of class. And they experience it in very racialized ways. They both experience it in racialized ways, whether white or black. And there's some things that are shared there, and there are some things that are absolutely not shared. And the segregation of the country, which has sharpened in recent years, has not declined, makes that more difficult, right? Because people don't live by each other. They don't talk to each other. White people flee Philadelphia for the suburbs and don't have any kind of shared experience with people who are abandoned in North and West and South Philadelphia. And, you know, we need a better way of understanding these things that doesn't fall for either, you know, black people really just need to get on the class boat, or that people talking about class, of course, are diverting attention away from these other struggles, or, you know, especially when both of these can be ploys for the Democrats.
Totally right. I mean, the scariest thing for me, I was talking about this with Doug earlier today, is kind of the idea that, like, well, there are racist whites, and they need to not be catered to, as if speaking to people who we may or may not write off as racist or bigots, as if that's somehow, I mean, that's like, not to sound corny, but that's kind of one of the only ways that we fight the racism. Like, you're not enabling racism when you speak to people in terms that they understand, because white people, like every other all people, people aren't angelic, right? People are self-interested. They're like humans. We all respond to material conditions and to, like, ideology, right? And so the idea that somehow these people need to be written off, and that to address their concerns is somehow a betrayal of non-whites, I just think is so dangerous. And it's also just, like, forget the morality of it. Just from a strategy point of view, like, the plan is just wait for these people to die off. It all comes full circle. It is all I want for Christmas.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, W.B. Du Bois did not spend 800 pages writing about the great potential and possibility of class unity around the Civil War, only to say that we should, you know, abandon these questions. I think we need to take poor whites with the utmost seriousness, but that does not mean catering to what they believe, right? And I think it often means, you know, hitting them upside the head, or it often means them feeling very uncomfortable, frightened, dislocated, scared, and being told that they are absolutely wrong in what they've been taught is the explanation for their condition. And so I think, one of the mistakes is to say, well, if you take them seriously, it means just bowing to their existing consciousness. And when the idea is that blacks in the history of the United States have struggled alongside white militants and white poor people, and have struggled against them. And both of those things have been productive and good. And both of those things point toward class unity. And that's, I think, what's hard for people to understand, is that, black workers struggling against white workers over their privileges builds a stronger unity, right? It builds a stronger working class that understands how to unify and fight.
Yeah. Arish Singh, who's a comedian, a really smart guy, who's Sikh American. I had him on my show. And one of the things he said that was, like, so not obvious, but so not that simple, but and yet such an important point that's rarely made, is he's like, when angry white people are dismissed or written off as, like, irredeemably bigoted, or as, like, having no kind of as having no reasonable demands at all, it's like, the people who suffer the most are me. He said this, like, are people of color, like, the people at the receiving end of racism, the ones who who think strategically, I would say, I mean, obviously people who I agree with politically, like, he's saying, like, we're the ones who are hurt when we refuse to, and he's not self-loathing. He's not saying go punch the guy in the arm when he makes a racist joke and tell him, yeah, it's just a joke, who cares? I know you're good people. No, he's saying, like, you talk to people. I mean, this is kind of like the first election where people are kind of openly saying, like, it's beneath us to try to change hearts and minds. And I'm used to being the one who's like, that's not enough, like, touchy-feely kumbaya. But, like, that's not even the minimum anymore. Anyway.
Yep. We need to change hearts and minds. But that doesn't, like, again, that we change that through struggle.
Sure. And there's a Venn diagram, right? There are people who are already with us. There are people who are never going to be with us. And then they're most people, I think, are in that middle ground where they need to be fought for. Again, it's like, I don't care if you could think that these are garbage people, whatever classist terms people use, trash, like backwoods, bigots, toothless, whatever. I mean, I disagree with you. But even if you think that, you want these people not to vote for the racist. Which of the books do you buy first?
So Decolonizing Dialectics drops maybe the beginning of February, late January, from Duke University Press. Building the Commune is currently on sale from Verso, and these things are cheap. I think everything's 50% off. I think the ebook maybe is 90% off. And so, you know, you're basically hardly contributing to capital accumulation at all.
Yeah, and you're teaching people how to dismantle capitalism, so it's a win.
Absolutely.
And you guys, it's not too late. You know you still owe people some presents. So after you've done the Katie Halper Show Patreon donation, which is clearly, you know, where your loyalties lie. No, just kidding. You can do both. In fact, give me less so you can buy this book. How do you like that? I'm such a martyr. Any resolution, a New Year's resolution, or the best takeaway from this year's election, the worst takeaway that you think needs to die, the worst narrative you think needs to die, any resolution you recommend for anyone?
I think it's become perfectly clear that the Democrats won't save us. They don't understand political power. They don't understand the powers in the streets. And I think that people are willing to resist Trump, and we need to keep that resistance outside of the formal political apparatus. And we need to understand that the reason that the country is transformed is because people are fighting in the streets. They're not fighting within the party necessarily. Bernie Sanders, who I'm very sympathetic with, is a reflection and an echo of decades of struggle. And the only reason that we are in a situation which we very could well have had a self-described socialist for president is because those struggles have broken out. And it's no coincidence that they've broken out in the Black community and around Black struggles against police brutality, which have always been the focal point in this country for broader popular struggles, from abolition, setting off early, you know, waves of feminism and socialism, to the civil rights movement, in which white youth saw the courageous resistance of particularly Black Southerners to Jim Crow, and that inspired them to become militants in turn. And I think that's where our power is, and that's how we need to understand it in the coming years, because the Democrats will not save us. Trying to get a populist at the head of the Democratic Party or as a candidate as a palliative measure, which is not going to help us fight Trumpism, because the Democrats have systematically misunderstood how Trumpism works, and that's a huge part of why they lost this election.
Ooh, so you're like, don't fall for this Ellison Paris divide.
I mean, in a way, it's interesting, but like, it's the Democratic Party trying to not die,
right?
And yeah, so
you're calling for Democrat genocide.
I hope, exactly. Man. I was like, the thing was like, cool if Bernie wins. If not, hopefully both parties destroy themselves.
Right. And now, yeah, unfortunately, as Trump ascends.
I mean, we need to be prepared to directly resist the Trump presidency, to do so in the streets, to directly resist police brutality and police violence, and to resist this plan to deport millions across the southern border, and to do so through organization in and around affected communities, through the establishment of, what are called rapid response networks for both police brutality on the one hand and deportations, and the idea is that, communities are able to defend themselves, and they're able to, to play a huge role in organizing resistance to make these things go away, or to make, to make Trump's, to make Trump, to make it impossible for Trump to govern the country.
Right. Ungovernability.
Ungovernable.
Nice. All right. So that's your New Year's resolution, ungovernability.
My New Year's resolution is ungovernable.
It is ungovernable. Nice. Well, thank you so much, George Chicarello Maher. And definitely come back and let us know when you're in New York City. We'll have you live in studio.
Of course. You'll have me for some pizza for sure.
Yes.
All right.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.